And joining us now in the studio, we have Kelly Barth, author of My Almost Certainly Real Imaginary Jesus, a memoir, and also longtime employee of the Raven Bookstore. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me today.
Hey, thanks for coming on. How are you doing?
Good.
All right. So before we get started, why don't you tell us a little bit, or tell our audience a little bit about yourself?
I am a writer, as you just mentioned, mm-hmm. and have lived in Lawrence since 1992. I moved here from, I actually grew up in Raytown. I went to UMKC for undergrad and then went to writing school in University of Montana. And when I moved back to Kansas City, where family was, I realized that the town was entirely too large, so I moved to Lawrence as soon as I could and have been here ever since, and have a partner, Lisa Grossman, who's a painter, local landscape painter, and we're very happy here.
So tell us a little bit about your work. I know you've got the one memoir and a number of publishing credits to your name.
Yes.
Are you pretty much exclusively nonfiction, or what else?
Well, I started out writing, I guess you would call it short stories. I thought that was what I would do, but I was writing thinly veiled stories about wanting to be a lesbian and being afraid to be, and so when I was in my last semester at Montana, I had a teacher who had us do kind of an exercise where we wrote fiction, or we told a story about our lives, and then she had us fictionalize it. Mm-hmm. And I realized then that I was probably better at telling the story in a nonfiction format. So when I graduated, I came back to moved to Lawrence and decided I would try to, I felt like a longer piece was inside of me, and I tried to tell that in fictional form and realized the genre was getting in the way. So I screwed up my courage and decided to go ahead and just tell it in nonfiction. And so that's what I ended up doing, and it felt so much more comfortable than all the fictional attempts I'd made over the years. But now I feel like there's an idea for a novel that's been kind of sitting inside for a while that needs to be told. So all bets are off. I don't know whether I'll feel comfortable doing it or not, but I'm going to try.
So you have the memoir.
Yes.
And you said you wrote that after getting back here to Lawrence?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Started once I moved to Lawrence. It took me, because I still had to try to make a living while I was doing it, it took me 10 years to write the draft. Plus, there were all sorts of coming out issues involved. And so, for a while I had to trick myself into believing no one would see it, and then at a certain point I realized, okay, somebody probably will see this, and so there were lots of fits and starts.
Yeah, it's a classic dilemma in nonfiction.
Right, exactly.
Sort of, this happened, and people are going to know.
Yeah, exactly.
And so maybe that's related to the question of being here, writing that in Lawrence, going through that process. How have you found, as sort of a place to be a writer, how have you found Lawrence?
Well, it's a great place because when I was in Montana, I was in the writing program, so I was better connected to the daily rigors and joys of the writing community. And I found so many reasons not to write. When I was in my graduate program there, I ended up going to so many parties and so many readings, and it was a great place not to write. So when I moved here, I was, I think, probably intentionally avoiding lots of socializing with writers at first, just because I needed some silence and time, but have since better integrated and have met some of my lifelong friends here who are good readers for me, and people are generally just really kind and supportive, and there isn't so much to keep involved with that you don't work. This writing program, I guess if I were to compare the two, this writing program produces people who really write, who spend a good deal of time working.
Here and, at KU.
Yes.
Well, that is very relevant, at least for me personally, because I have thought about that of, boy, I hope when I graduate, I can make myself keep writing.
So, exactly.
Good to hear a positive example.
Yeah.
And on the topic of that involvement, you, as a having this long history with the Raven, you are involved with the Big Tent series regularly?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. I'm not involved in setting things up. I'm not a curator, but I work on Thursday nights. So that's my evening to be there. And mm-hmm. so I've been able to witness lots of readings. And it's a great series. Mm-hmm. Usually it's a three-act. Usually a couple poets or a couple fiction writers, prose writers, and often a play. Sometimes it's two, but it's always good. So, yeah, it's a great place for people to be heard and to be heard again. We have any number of published and non-published writers. It's a great venue.
It is, yeah. I've always enjoyed being at the Big Tent, and you will be at... This month.
I'll be at March's Big Tent. Yep. Mm-hmm. A good friend, Mary Wharf, and I will be reading together.
And do you know what you'll be reading at that?
I do. I'm going to be reading another, it's not from the book. I'll be reading one of the essays that I, you know, when I was working on the book, I felt like there were lots of personal essays that were sort of windfall, lying on the ground, and I'd worry that I wouldn't get to them. Mm-hmm. So I tried to keep jotting notes down of things I wanted to work on when I was freed up. And so this is one of those ideas that I've been playing with. So I'll be reading that. My avocation is wildlife rehabilitation. So that's the fodder for many, many personal essays, because it's a very strange thing to do. And so I'll be reading something related to that this month's Big Tent.
You have my interest. I there was a time when I was like, how the heck do I get into wildlife rehabilitation?
I'm not
faking that. I really,
yeah, oh, good. Oh, good.
I was
that
sounds like the most interesting job. So
it is. It is.
Good. Good to hear this. So without further ado, should we move into what you've brought today?
Sure. I grew up in a moderately religious Presbyterian home, we talked about Jesus quite a bit. And one of the things that I learned from early on was that Jesus could live in my heart. So I assumed then, you know, as a young person, we're fairly literal, and I assumed then he must be about 2.5 inches tall or less. And so if he could live in my heart, you know, so I looked for him everywhere, and he ended up being an imaginary friend to me. And so the memoir kind of is my discussion of how that imaginary friend, the Jesus of history, was a far kinder, more supportive, loving force in my life than the Jesus of the church that I ended up becoming overly familiar with. So I grew up gay and Christian, and so that's the memoirs about what an odd experience that was for me.
I'll do a little preface.
And as a part of that experience, I ended up going to what many people will be familiar with, an ex-gay ministry. So the gist of it is you end up trying to take some courses. It's not intellectual in the slightest, but you end up going to sessions to become straight. And it doesn't work, I will say, as a preface to that. And so it's usually 6 months to a year of pointless soul-searching and pointless self-abuse. So this is from the chapter called Living Waters, which was the name of that ministry. And this is intended to be bittersweet and funny, so don't worry if it sounds that way. So we'll begin with Colleen, the extremely heterosexual leader of this ex-gay ministry. So you might be asking me, Colleen, why is a straight woman like you leading a ministry like this? She scratched deep in her fluffy hair with one long purple fingernail and began. Years earlier, she'd been looking at greeting cards in her neighborhood Christian bookstore and saw what she assumed to be a young woman browsing in marriage and sexuality. But then she heard a man's voice asking the clerk if she knew of any Christian books on homosexuality. The clerk said, "No, we don't have anything like that," and just walked away. My heart broke for him because the clerk seemed so afraid. Now, I'm not a shy woman, so I took him aside and asked him what kind of book he wanted. Here, Colleen's tears flowed again. In short, this man wanted a book about what to do next if you knew you shouldn't be a homosexual, a book that she lamented she could not yet help him find. But what he really wanted, she sobbed, was someone to tell him that God loved him. If you know you're loved, truly, that heals everything. The lie of homosexuality just falls away. The Lord told Colleen things about homosexuals that he didn't bother to tell homosexuals themselves. This often happens to prophets. God skipped the Ninevites and talked to Jonah about them instead. It's a religious game of telephone that leaves so much room for errors in translation. Colleen made it her mission to help people, quote, out of homosexuality, which made me picture her pulling people from a burning vehicle or a flooded mine shaft. I didn't like the helpless feeling it gave me. But when one is being rescued, one mustn't struggle or resist or try to help. It only makes matters worse for you and your rescuer. The phrase "fox in the chicken house" looped in my brain like a bad song. I prayed that it would go away, but it didn't. I was a fox in the chicken house. We all were. You are helpless to change without deep, drastic healing from the touch of the Father Almighty, Colleen said. Your sexuality is beyond your control. You must give it to God. I basked for a moment at the end of this meeting in the pleasure of deep agreement. Keep them, these children of yours, and help them change, Colleen said in her closing prayer, telling God what she wanted to have happen to us. I could tell she dreaded ending the meeting and letting any of us out of her sight. Her prayers for me that evening did just what she had asked them to do. They left me dangerously capable of change. Imaginary Jesus would use her misguided ministry to jostle me from decades of sexual inertia brought on by the condemnation of people like her. He didn't want me to keep pretending I was sexless as a gum eraser, neither this nor that, here nor there. Imaginary Jesus and Colleen were both concerned about the need for a cure. They just didn't have the same outcome in mind. After the closing prayer, Colleen invited us to have foam cups of punch already poured and slices of dessert bread cut in half and laid on a napkin for us so we wouldn't have to touch anything. Eager to finally understand my condition and its causes and treatment, I purchased every last one of the books on the table at the back of the room, including Pursuing Sexual Wholeness and its accompanying workbook, Healthy Friendships, and Homosexuality, a New Christian Ethic. On the drive home, all of these books, their covers still shiny with newness, slid off the neat pile I had made of them onto the floor of the car I'd borrowed from my parents. There they scratched over road salt, gum wrappers, and plastic cup lids. As I mentally ticked off the once familiar freeway exits toward what no longer felt like home, Roe, State Line, Warnell, Gregory, I reviewed what I had learned. 1. God could reverse a lifetime of sexual maturation in only 8 months. 2. If I stayed out of his way, I would no longer want to act on my feelings for other women, even if I still had them. 3. I might even feel attracted to someone of the opposite sex. 4. In another 8 months, I might look like Colleen with long purple nails and a plaid suit. Outside of the spell of her presence, her predictions about my future made far less sense. As I remembered this specific prediction, I hit the brakes and only accelerated again when I saw headlights of the car behind me approaching fast. Though I could not yet envision such a thing, if Colleen was right and God wanted me to look like her, then I guessed I could learn to want that too. He was the potter, I was the clay. Internal conflict made even walking difficult. I stumbled up several stairs of my parents' split level, dropping the brightly colored ex-gay books as I went. This wouldn't be the last time that I, like Dostoevsky's Raskolnikov, would parade my crime in front of the dull-witted authorities, subconsciously hoping to be apprehended. That night I went to bed with a splitting headache, the first of a series of Tuesday night sexual healing barn burners.
Thanks so much for sharing that, Kelly. It brings back a lot of Bible Belt memories. That took place in your after grad school?
It did, yes. I persisted in trying not to think, even after grad school. I did. I think this is kind of the end of that stubbornness. So,
okay. Well, that was great, and really intrigued at the rest of the story.
So great.
Thank you so much for coming on. Looking forward to the Big Ten at the end of the month.
Thanks, Scott.
All right. You have a great night.
All right, you too.